Hi, my name is Mandy Jackson Beverly, and I'm a bibliophile. Welcome to the Bookshop Podcast. Each week, I present interviews with independent bookshop owners from around the globe, authors, and specialists in subjects dear to my heart, the environment and social justice. To help the show reach more people, please share it with friends and family and on social media. And remember to subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen to this podcast. You're listening to episode 210. Paulina Porizková is a Czechoslovak-born writer. A former model, she was the first Central European woman to appear on the cover of the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue in 1984. In 1988, she became one of the highest-paid models in the world as the face of Estée Lauder. She has starred in 16 movies and a slew of TV shows as an actress, and she has served as part of the judging panel on Cycle 10 of America's Next Top Model. Paulina was born in Alamauk in 1965 and grew up in the Moravian town of Prostějovice, a city dating back to 1141 in what was, at the time, Czechoslovakia. In 1968, during the wake of the Soviet-led invasion, Paulina's parents escaped Czechoslovakia and settled in Sweden, leaving her behind with her grandmother. Her mother went back to Czechoslovakia to get her daughter, only to be captured and taken to prison, where, because she was pregnant, was put under house arrest with Paulina and her grandmother and soon-to-be-born brother for 3 years. Amid media coverage, Paulina, her brother, and her mother were later allowed to enter Sweden. However, the rest of her family remained in Czechoslovakia. Paulina's debut novel, A Model Summer, was published in 2007, and her memoir, No Filter, The Good, The Bad, and The Beautiful, was published by The Open Field in 2022. Hi, Paulina, and welcome to the show. It's lovely to chat with you again.
Thanks, Mandy. Well, it's nice to see your friendly face again, having had a discussion moderated by you at El Encanto, which was lovely, which was great.
Well, thank you. And I enjoyed chatting with you too. That was a fun event. And from the feedback I've had, everybody there thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the US after your whirlwind trip to Europe. And by the look of one of your Instagram posts, your last night was quite a send-off. I'd love it if you could share with us what happened while you were watching Carmen with 3,099 other theatergoers.
It was insanity. And so, yeah, of course, so my trip, first of all, was just a nonstop event of, you know, doing photo models, red carpets. I mean, it was just nonstop. And our last stop was going to be close to Vienna, where they have this beautiful old stone quarry that can seat like up to 4,000 people with this enormous stage. And they were going to be doing Carmen, of course, is one of the most popular operas in the world. And I thought a wonderful introduction from my boyfriend, Jeff, who is sort of an opera neophyte. And I thought, what a great introduction into opera with one of the most, you know, recognizable operas. And we get there and it's very hot. And this is close to Vienna. So it's maybe about 30 kilometers from Vienna. And Austria doesn't get really that hot. So it's not set up for heat. It's not like, you know, parts of the South in the United States. It was hot. It was beastly hot. And we were sitting there and I was fanning myself. But, you know, the opera is ongoing and I couldn't believe the performers working in such heat, and they were magnificent. It was all just absolutely beautiful. And all the songs, you know, come up and it sort of makes your heart soar. And then there's a first intermission. Carmen is still madly in love. Everything is going well on stage. And we retire to a little balcony where it's like a little champagne during intermission. And as we're sipping our champagne, all of a sudden, this gust of wind out of nowhere, it seemed. Champagne glasses are flying in the air. They're crashing. Umbrellas are being taken up and ripped and just torn, like, you know, thrown on the floor. Audience is starting to panic. And then rain, torrential downpour rain, and the whole thing. And it's a quarry. So it goes, you know, it's like a little bowl. And people are you know, people are screaming and people are trying to get out of this place. Fortunately, no one was hurt. It sort of like seemed like the end of the world at one moment, but it was safe. Everybody got to their cars. We were all drenched to the bone. But what I thought was amusing, since nobody got hurt, the newspapers the following day reported on it as Carmen lives. Unexpected moment in opera, Carmen lives.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, we got to participate in that. And that was a really wonderful send-off, a very dramatic but unforgettable send-off to a fairly unforgettable, eventful, well, I was going to say vacation, which it wasn't, a work trip.
Yes, the photos you posted on Instagram were stunning. But I'm guessing in regards to Carmen, that was it. The show was done, right? No going back after intermission.
No. The storm didn't destroy the stage and it just got everything extremely wet. But they were unable to continue. And it's like, it's this mega $1 million production that just got cut in the middle. They did offer people tickets for another night. All of us who didn't get to see Carmen die were welcome back to watch it again. Of course, we could not take them up on it because we had to go back to the States. So Jeff now knows half of an opera.
He's had a taste. Jeff's going to have to go back and watch Carmen again and hopefully get to see the second half.
Exactly. Now we have to see Carmen again.
And did he enjoy what he saw?
How could you not? You know, all the greatest arias of Carmen too are in Act One. So you can't help but sort of like sing along with it, or at least sort of move along with it a little bit as you're hearing it. So in some ways, it was probably the best introduction to an opera that you could have had because the drama was there.
Well, it's one he'll never forget, right?
I won't ever forget it. And I've seen a lot of operas.
Okay, let's go from operas to books. In 2007, Hachette Books published your novel, A Model Summer. And here we are, 16 years later, and your memoir, No Filter, The Good, The Bad, and The Beautiful, was published by The Open Field, an imprint of Penguin Random House, founded by Emmy Award-winning journalist, producer, and New York Times best-selling author, Maria Shriver. Can you share the story about Maria reaching out to you? Because it makes me chuckle.
Oh, it makes me chuckle too, because I still can't believe that this is my life, that this kind of stuff actually happens. And it happens to me. You're familiar with my Instagram presence, and I have been using Instagram sort of in an unorthodox way, because I tend to really use it to write down my thoughts and perspective and things that happen. And also when, after my husband died and a lot of stuff hit me at the same time. And during COVID, I was sort of using it as a way to connect to other people who were not having a fabulous time in their lives. Instead of posting, you know, just glamorous pictures of myself all the time. So I was posting my vulnerable self out there on the social media. And so the people that followed me were, I think, following me for the honesty, for not having a perfect life, not having it together at all. So one day, and this is now almost 2 years ago, I get a phone call and it's from Maria Shriver. Now, I know who Maria Shriver is, but I don't know her personally. I've never met her. I did a talk show with her ex-husband once, but that's as close as I got. And so I was like, wait, why is Maria Shriver calling me? What's going on? Am I a bad Democrat? No, she said hello and that she follows me on Instagram and that she loves what I'm doing on Instagram and she loves what I'm writing about and that she's starting a new imprint on Penguin Random and that she would love for me to write her a book sort of in the way that I write my Instagram. So it was, I think the way she originally sort of had it was like devotionals, it's a little bit in the way that she had structured her own book, which I believe is called I've Been Thinking. And I had been getting random offers from agents after my husband's death that wanted a, you know, tell-all memoir and that I was not into. I couldn't emotionally do it, nor did I morally want to do that. But when Maria said this, she inspired me. I thought, oh, that is something I could do. I could write a book sort of the way that I write Instagram with the things that I think about and the things that I've been processing in the last 3 years. Sorry, that's my dog.
That's okay. Mine may bark back.
Right.
Ludwig!
He's also deaf, so he won't hear me shouting at him. So I got inspired by the idea of how I could approach writing a book. Then, of course, having no idea of what a devotional was, I just went and wrote essays. Well, I wrote one essay so that the book publisher could see whether they wanted to purchase the book or not. Then I went off and did a reality show in the jungle, which completely killed my already slightly arthritic hips, which then became a lot more arthritic. I came back to the States and I came back to Maria saying, yes, we want to buy the book. And only little thing that I would like of you here is that it would be finished by March 1st. This conversation happened on November 29th. So I was like, so that gives me 3 months to write a book. So again, me not understanding the concept of the book, you know, sometimes things happen for the wrong reason, but they end up being the right thing. And I think my book was an example of this. I sort of misunderstood my homework. I sat down and just opened my veins and poured out these essays. And that was okay. And I delivered it by March 1st. And everybody seemed fairly happy with it.
And as you were writing the book, did it flow fairly easily? Or did you have hair-pulling moments where you just thought, what am I doing?
Well, given that in order to finish a book from start to finish in 3 months, I had to sort of wake up in the morning and then write all day until my brain melted, sometimes in the afternoon. There were days in which things were a little harder for me. I had this really wonderful woman who was sort of like my reader. I don't think you could do this by yourself without having somebody to read your material. And she would read it, you know, I would send her things and she would get back to me the following morning. And then she would sort of let me know like, oh, this piece was boring. This, you know, you should highlight this. And at one point she said, you need to write an essay about meeting your husband and falling in love with your husband, because I'm getting a lot of the after effects of what, you know, happened after his death. But I can't place him as a reader. I'm not really like, I'm not sure why you were in love with this man. And this was the only time that the essays got where it was difficult for me, where I had to sit down and I had to go back to the good times. I had to remember things I was trying not to remember at this point, because I was still in a pretty deep, dark place after my husband's death and the consequent, you know, will, where he did not want to leave me anything because of some, I guess, lawyer speak for let's not leave her any money. So that was challenging and beautiful, because once I accessed that part, once I opened that specific vein that did not want to be open because it was still really, really sore, what I got out of it was the love that was there for my husband and with my husband was real. We had many really wonderful, loving years. People can call it a toxic relationship. They can say it was immature, it was imbalanced, it wasn't the right kind. But it still led to love, a long, long amount of time that was filled with love. And remembering it and writing it down made me be able to sort of forgive him for what had happened towards the end. So that was the one small sort of cathartic moment in writing the book. The rest of it was just things that had been filling me for, you know, 2 years that I've been working on and processing and thinking about and agonizing over. So they were at my fingertips. But the love for my husband hadn't been at my fingertips at that very moment. And the book, sort of having to write about it, let it bubble up to the surface.
I was impressed with not only how you approached grief in the book, but also how you wrote about it. It's not an easy subject to write about.
Thank you.
You know, we've all lost someone, and no matter what the circumstances, there is pain involved. My own experience with grief is that grief doesn't have an expiration date. It comes in waves, and our grief changes constantly. And all of our grief is handled personally. It's different for every single person.
And I'm not, it's not like I'm over it. It's not like I'm fixed or healed. Sometimes grief still strikes at really odd moments. And I still have some pretty dark days. I mean, it's just, it's what it is. It's been almost 4 years, and it can still get, pretty hard at times, but I'm no longer angry at him. And I think that was the most important thing to sort of unload so that I could start healing without bitterness, you know, without blaming others for what happened, being able to take some responsibility myself.
Yeah, that's a big step. And it's also a big step being able to just verbalize that, right? You know, it's funny. I often think that it's strange we've never met before, apart from when we were in El Encanto, because in the 80s, I was working in the music industry, mainly doing music videos as a costume designer stylist. But I mainly worked in Los Angeles, and I never got to work with you, and I never got to work with Rick. I thought it was a great time to be in Los Angeles, and I'm sure New York. There was so much creativity, especially in the film industry, in fashion, the arts, writing. It was just wonderful. I had a great time. But I worked my butt off, just like you did, I'm sure.
Well, I think, you know, the 80s were a period of sort of social unrest to a certain extent and upheaval, and that always creates art. When other things are taken away from us as we go to art. Yes, I agree. I think the 80s were a very exciting time, but I think now is also a very exciting time. It's a scary time. But I think if the one thing that will come out of this will be a flourishing art scene, which has been kind of lazy for a while.
Yeah, I would love to see a renaissance, a rebirth of the arts. We need more Shepard Fairies and Banksys. And I see Gen Z as a more of a entrepreneurial, nonprofit reaching out. They want to try to change things and make a difference, which is fantastic. But I would love to see rebellious new artists hitting the streets and the art scene.
Yeah, well, I think we're creating the background for it. That unfortunately is what makes those kind of things flourish. Because yeah, we need a change. We need a change in the art world as well as the political world.
Yes, I absolutely agree. When you were the guest author for the Lunch with an Author literary series at El Encanto, you took the time to chat with one of the young ladies who was there and had just started modeling. And apart from being excited that you'd taken the time to chat with her, she was very grateful for the information you gave her. And it made me think about a quote in an interview you did with Eileen Prose in the 80s. And you said, quote, "Modeling is a wonderful thing if it's a step to the next step. And it's a terrible thing if it's the only step you're ever going to take." End quote. Can you expand on that quote a little?
Well, with that, I just mean that to, you know, for a young girl to imagine that what she wants to do with her life is to become a model. It's a terrible idea because it's so time limited and it's so specific to the way you look and whether your looks are in style or not. And it's so much up to other people. It's not something that you have any control over. So it's a terrible idea of a career, one that you actually have no power in whatsoever. And it's not like modeling is based on talent. It is based on the way you look mathematically. Your specific arrangement of features mathematically, does it photograph well? Well, I would not like to build a life career based on that. And I didn't. I never even imagined modeling. To me, it was a summer job that I thought, oh, how amazing. Like, anybody wants me to be a model. How exciting. And then the summer job took off and seemed so incredibly lucrative that it would have been crazy to not pursue it and use it. And I thought, well, I will be able to use this as a next step to the things I really want to do. I will go in and I will make money, and then I'll be able to pursue the things that I really want to do. And it sucked me in a little bit more than I expected. I was way more successful than I could have ever dreamt, which, in a funny way, I mean, it took me down a different path than I expected. You know, I did think I was going to go back to school. I was really interested in archaeology and psychology and very different things from fashion. In fact, I'm still to this day completely uninterested in fashion. I have never liked fashion and I never will. It's just not to me. I appreciate it in other people. I can see the art and the beauty in it when it's done well. I have no interest in myself and fashion. I can see it as an art form for others. So for me, modeling was just, I thought was going to be biding my time and getting what I could get out of it, which was surprisingly a lot more than I thought.
And then you went into acting.
I did. And the acting was far more rewarding to me on an emotional and personal level because it gave me agency. I wasn't just a paper doll. You know, I got to be a person or get to act different facets of my personality, which I found really challenging. And so that was fun to me. I mean, I probably did like 16 or more movies. And while I really enjoyed it, I really had to fight very hard to be seen as a person in the acting business because everybody just wanted to cast me as the pretty girlfriend. And I felt like, well, that was my job all along, was to be the pretty one that really had no character. So I don't want to go into another career and be exactly the same thing. So I was trying to get the more interesting parts, which nobody wanted me for. And so eventually I just thought, you know, I'm not hungry enough to pursue it, to really buckle down and do the work that needs to be done to pursue this. And the writing thing had always been in my back pocket. It was, I think, the number one favorite thing of mine is to read. And this has been true since I learned to read. So at 4 or 5, I am primarily a reader and I consume books in huge amounts. But of course, I also switched countries 4 times. So that means changing languages 4 times, changing cultures and changing the history and sort of the reference points of literature. So I always, when I was a kid, when I was in school, I used to write plays and I used to perform the plays. But the writing was always something that appealed to me, you know, as a form of self-expression rather than the way I dressed up or the way I danced or sang or artistically, that was always sort of my favorite mode. It's just that I didn't exactly know how. Because, I stayed in school until 9th grade and that was it. So I never actually even learned how to write an essay. When I was writing a book of them, I had to first figure out what an essay was and how they were structured because I had no idea.
So what year of high school did you leave or did you even go to high school?
I never went to high school.
In retrospect, you self-educated yourself after grade 9.
All of this stuff is self-taught, yeah.
I'm impressed, Paulina.
Well, thank you.
Let's talk about family, because you and I both have sons who are older.
That's right.
So I'd love your thoughts on this, because growing up with a male-dominated family, my husband, 2 sons, and then me, it had its challenges at times. For example, you know, if I wanted to make the table pretty and I'd put candles out, by the time I brought the food to the table, one of the sons would have been playing with the wax and the candle was most likely out. And it was fine. I mean, they were curious kids, which I liked. But what happened was when they left home, I kind of got into a groove of self-discovery a little bit and I was still working. But now I've just had my 64th birthday and I have found that need for exploring my femininity has become stronger. Not necessarily, you know, dressing more feminine or anything like that. What I mean is visiting my maternal relatives, my mother, and I find this fascinating. So I'd love to hear about your experience growing up with your sons.
That's such an interesting question. I don't think anybody's ever asked me that before. So first of all, when I was little, I mean, it's in my book, but I basically raised my little brother. At the age of 3, once we got to Sweden, I was his primary caretaker for a long time. And so I was with this little boy for my entire childhood. And then when I met my husband, he had 4 sons already from 2 previous marriages. So this was a lot of male energy, but also my husband and his sons, and I say this in the most positive of ways, my husband had a lot of, he was very in touch with sort of what we would consider feminine qualities. In our house, if somebody put on a candle, it would probably be my husband. My husband would take 1 to 2 hours every day to get dressed and get himself together, only to go down in the basement and sit there for the rest of the 14 hours. He was the one that sort of, you know, he had a vain streak about him. He loved fashion. He was the one that would go out and buy really nice clothes. I was, you know, I'd be kicking around in like a 40-year-old Gap dress. And my husband is the one that would buy the Yves Saint Laurent t-shirt for, you know, $600. So we had it a little reversed that way. And I always felt like I was slightly more on the masculine side of feminine, and he was slightly more feminine on the side of masculine. So it was a really good balance. And my sons, likewise, are sort of somewhat effeminate in vulnerability, sensitivity. They are arty, so, but they're also techies, so they're a little they're nerds. But I felt like I was the undoubted queen of the household, but I was also the captain of the ship. And my boys, sometimes when I had to get dressed up to go to an event or something with my husband, and my sons would come by and go, "Mommy, you look so beautiful. I love your shiny pants." And so I never felt, and also we are like a family, we have zero idea of sports. I mean, zero. When somebody mentions basketball, to this day, I'll be like, "What kind of a ball is that? And what do you do with it?" So I always get it mixed up with baseball. And it's like, I have like the typical masculine pursuits, not at our house. We sat around and played instruments for fun. You know, we would jam to, for example, La Folia, which is a piece. I think Vivaldi did a version of it, and Paganini did a version of it, and Tchaikovsky might have done a version of it, which is like a certain chord structure in a classical piece.
A chord progression.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, that's what we do for fun, is we jam to La Folia. So not particularly masculine household.
Yeah, we're actually a pretty musical family too, a creative family, definitely. Now, my husband and my two sons are avid Dodger and Laker fans. So you mix that in. I mean, some of the conversations, they may as well have been speaking another language, which they were. Now, while we're talking about women and femininity, I'd like to broach something that you and I talked about before in our conversation at El Encanto. There are millions of women all over the world who are extremely happy doing what they're doing, whether they're working full-time, part-time, homemakers, bringing up children, volunteering, whatever they're doing, they're thrilled to be doing it. But there are a lot of other women over 50, perhaps over 60, who feel a little trapped. Maybe they're too scared to do something that they've always wanted to do. It could be ceramics, painting, writing, traveling, cooking school, hiking, etc. So what would you say to women over 50 who shrink away from trying new life experiences and yet crave to delve into their innate curiosity? And you're still in your 50s, right?
I'm 58. I'm nearly in the 60s.
Okay. And I think what led me to ask you this question is because you did show your vulnerability. You explored a new way of showing your feelings to a very big audience. So I'd love to hear your thoughts. I think Wolfgang just answered the question. I'm seeing cats and dogs behind you. It's hysterical.
I'm just hearing it behind me, and my dog's on a whirlwind of catching nothing at all because he's half blind and can't hear it though.
But he's having fun. That's okay.
Well, you know, I think a lot of this was born out of necessity and pain, because I've also met a lot of women who are in their late 40s or early 50s who do not have happy marriages, who feel like they're not seen in their marriage, who feel like their husband doesn't notice them anymore. And their choices are, well, either I stick with what I know, safety, or I will brave the outside. And that could be potentially far more dangerous. I mean, that could kill me. So I understand those who make the choice to stay. But in my own world, I was so miserable not being loved, not feeling loved, that I couldn't bear it. I felt like I was dead already. And so I felt like anything that could happen to me couldn't be any worse than this slow death, this wilting away as a woman, as a person. It's like I was nobody. My career was dead. My marriage was dead. My children didn't need me anymore. Who was I? And when I came to my husband and tried to sort of wake him up and say, look, we're in trouble. I'm not happy. Can we work on this? He said, well, you work on it. I'm fine. And so when I couldn't rouse him, and it took years of trying to, you know, get this old car going no results. And I thought, okay, well, it's not about making myself happy. It's about I have to be able to live, because this is a kind of death. And this is when I asked my husband for a divorce. And even then, even when I asked him for a divorce, I thought he would jump too and go, oh, no, let's work on it. And he said, yeah, okay. It seems like you've already made up your mind, so whatever. So like he didn't even care.
That in itself must have been shocking for you. So sad to hear those words.
Yeah, I didn't know that that's where we were. Like I was in La La Land thinking I was somewhere else. We were on two very different planes, apparently. And so I started to make my way out of the marriage. And it was all because of pain. It was all because I just couldn't stand that pain anymore. It was the beginning of the dark times. And then, of course, my husband and I separated. And again, I thought everything was, you know, we separated as friends because he clearly didn't seem to mind that I didn't want to be in a marriage anymore. I fell in love again with somebody else. And then the shit hit the fan, as one says, where everything fell apart at about the same time. It wasn't a choice that I made. That wasn't my choice at all. This was circumstantial. That, you know, my husband died, my boyfriend left me, I had no money, and COVID. I had nothing to do with any of those, yet this was the position I was in. So I was operating from a place of, I just need to survive. And I think that, you know, that sort of survival mode, it forces you to, well, because you sink or you swim. Like, that's it. You've been thrown into the deep end and whatever happens, happens. So I'm not a great authority on, you know, taking charge of your life and getting yourself to where you want to go, because I was sort of thrust into it, I feel like. And all I did was survive.
And you survived with grace and dignity. There's a word that I find disheartening when I hear women use it toward another woman, and that is overachiever. Quite often what is perceived as another woman doing well or wanting to achieve something is actually that woman's way of trying to survive. I see this as a woman standing, and in front of her are dangled a whole lot of ropes of different lengths, and she has to grab on one to survive. So she grabs one and she works on that one, and whatever that gives her, she'll try to do. She'll do it the best she can. And sometimes that rope gives out, so she has to try another one to survive. And that survival isn't just about themselves. It's quite often about their family, their children, paying the rent, paying the mortgage, paying for school supplies, food on the table. It is really about survival. I would love to see women supporting women more, acknowledging each other for their hardships and their strengths. There are a lot of us doing that, but I think it could be more, and I think there needs to be more understanding of other women.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it does help when you know that somebody has traveled that path before you and has been honest about it and said, you know what, this was my situation and it sucked. And there is light on the other side. You don't know how long it's going to take you to get out of that tunnel. You don't know how well you do, but there's always a tomorrow. Well, as long as you're fortunate enough to have a tomorrow. And things can always change overnight. That's the darndest thing, is that things do change overnight. That nothing lasts. And of course, when you get to be our age, you also know the good things don't last either. So when you have the good thing, seize hold of it, love it, be grateful for it, enjoy it, because that too will pass.
And that is what I love about your Instagram. It's full of so many different emotions, the realities of getting older, and also the beauty of getting older. Paulina, it's been fabulous chatting with you once again. I feel very lucky. I hope we get to chat again soon.
Yes, we will. Absolutely.
And I am going to give a shout out to your friend, Misty. I know she's going through chemo again now. Our thoughts are with you, Misty. And I, for one, am inspired by your contagious smile.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, Misty is going through a lot, and she has been going through a lot with the most beautiful spirit and smile and sense of humor that just doesn't seem to, it deserts her at times, as it should, but somebody with that much gratitude for a good moment has taught me so much. It has taught me so much about gratitude. Rather wonderful to have friends who do love life, no matter what installment of life they have gotten or are stuck with. I get inspired by people who understand gratitude. And it's a word that is being really bandied about today, I think, a little bit too much. It is used for anything. I mean, it's basically used to sell you products at this point, which is unfortunate, but it is the one word that I've come to in my seasoned age that has made a tremendous difference. And I think you access it by aging, actually. I don't think you need to be grateful when you're 19. That's all right.
Yes, it is all right. I think the other G word that I love is grace. Grace and gratitude. They're definitely two words that I'm understanding more as I age. Or as you so beautifully put it, season with age.
You understand them, and you're also able to, I think that's when you find them. That is the beauty of age, is that's when you find grace and gratitude. And it makes the world a more beautiful place. It's actually, the world is far more beautiful than I ever suspected. And I already thought it was pretty cool.
Yes, it is. It's a wonderful, marvelous place. And I'm not giving up on it yet. Not yet. I'm more of a half glass full person these days.
And I am a perennial pessimist because I come from a Eastern European background where we like to moderate our expectations to somewhere below sea level. And like that, everything that is better than that is a pleasant surprise. So I have a lot of pleasant surprises every day. As long as I keep my expectations very low, I'm pretty happy because life outdoes my very modest expectations. And so I am more of a glass half empty, but that's fine kind of a person. That's all I need. I only need a half a glass of water.
Paulina, you are a gem. Thank you so much for chatting with me and being a guest on the Bookshop podcast.
Oh, thank you, Mandy. And it was a pleasure chatting with you too.
You've been listening to my conversation with Paulina Porizkova, chatting about her new book, No Filter, The Good, The Bad, and The Beautiful. To find out more about the Bookshop podcast, go to thebookshoppodcast.com and make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen to the show. You can also follow me at Mandy Jackson Beverly and the Bookshop podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and on YouTube at the Bookshop podcast. If you have a favorite indie bookshop that you'd like to suggest we have on the podcast, I'd love to hear from you via the contact form at thebookshoppodcast.com. The Bookshop Podcast is written and produced by me, Mandy Jackson Beverly. Theme music provided by Brian Beverly, executive assistant to Mandy, Adrian Otterhan, and graphic design by Francis Farala. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.